Under the skin. Hey, so I'm very excited about this particular episode of Under the Scales. I've done one deep dive before, and that was on tapers. And if you guys will remember, because I'm not a subject matter expert in various fields, I will get an expert with me to do deep dive interviews. And today I'm extremely honored and happy to have in the Under the Scales studio in New York City, with me, Dan Cantor. How are you, Dan?
Hey, everybody. Thanks for having me, Tom.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm very honored.
Oh, gosh. The honor is all mine, and I'm so happy that you're here.
Thank you. Me too.
Dan's here as an expert on guitars, and if you guys hadn't figured out by now, we are going to do a deep dive into Trey Anastasio's guitars. Now, he's got a bunch, and but he doesn't function as a normal multi-guitar star.
Yeah.
And I've seen you play, Dan,
sure,
on stage, and you're more like the 70s kind of guy where a song ends
and I switch
and a dude runs out with a different guitar.
Yeah, I mean, that's just to fulfill my high school fantasies, you know.
Well, it's a good one.
Because I could. But also, I needed different guitars for different songs and different sounds, and so I find it fascinating that Trey gets everything he needs from his one guitar, and I'm sure, as we're going to talk about, his guitar is so unique that it just, you know, it could work as a Les Paul or work as a Strat, you know, and it's just, there's so many functions on it.
Right, and being a semi-hollow is interesting too.
Yeah,
in the world of rock.
Yeah, fully hollow, his guitar.
Fully hollow? Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Now, so let's talk a little bit about your credentials, Dan. Why are you here as a guitar expert? And let me just fill in what I know so
okay.
far. So I met Dan at a Phish show. I think it might have been Bader Field in Atlantic City.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. Nice. And a nice guy came up to me and said that he's a big fan of you know, Phish and my words,
yeah,
and started talking. And before long, I figured out that you kept referring to your boss.
Yeah, my 15-year-old boss.
Yeah, it turns out that Dan Cantor's boss was Justin Bieber. So how did that happen, and what happened there? So you're his guitarist, songwriter, friend, mentor,
yeah, musical director. I was working in, I mean, short story, I was working in Toronto as a musical director for all these pop acts. I love playing guitar, but my dad directs musical theater. So very early on, when I was working with an artist, I couldn't help but tell them, you know, work with them on their stage banter, working the stage, not like choreography, but just, you know, how to be a front person, how to say Cleveland, make some noise.
And how did you know that?
Just from going to shows and seeing my dad direct, you know, in theater. I always saw it as bigger. I love, you know, when the band goes, but if there's like a dance move and the lights pop all with that, you know, that little accent.
It makes that
accent,
so much more powerful.
It makes it so huge. And then someone in the audience really, you know, reacts to that.
Right.
And Justin at the time, he had a song out on the radio and he was doing a little promo tour and he was about to do some big TV appearances. And his management thought it was time to bring someone else on who could be a guitarist, a musical mentor, eventually, you know, grow into the role as a musical director. And fortunately, this decision happened while they were in Canada. So really just a coincidence.
That's great.
That we're both Canadian. But I think when I first met him, we really hit it off because I was the first Canadian he had hung with in a while because
right.
he was in the States. So we talked about hockey and Tim Hortons coffee and this band, the Tragically Hip, who we love in Canada.
Yeah. And also eventually Phish. You got Justin into
Phish.
Well,
and then Phish. I mean, of course. Yeah.
That's a long
Everyone
story, though.
Everyone knows me.
That's down the road a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Because in between when you met him and getting Justin to his first Phish show,
mm-hmm.
He, of course, became an international superstar with you right
Crazy.
There on stage with him every single concert.
Yeah.
That's amazing, Dan.
It's unbelievable. I mean, especially to think about it now, it was such a roller coaster. And,
yeah.
What a crazy trip.
Yeah, yeah, amazing. And I have to say, Dan involved me and Trey, of course, and other people from the fish community got involved in funny ways. So one, in a professional manner, you guys might know that Chris Kuroda did some lights for the Justin Bieber tour when he was not working for Fish. Mm-hmm. And so that was a sort of a professional thing. But more humorous, Dan invited me and turns out Trey to a Madison Square Garden concert. Justin Bieber. And I gotta say, that woman, Carly Rae Jepsen, opened, that might have been the loudest thing I've ever heard in my life. I think my,
everyone singing Call Me Maybe.
Well, that, and also just the crazy bass they had there. It was like, honestly, if I didn't have, like, I normally wear earplugs even for Fish. I was just thanking my lucky stars I had them, because that was on.
You wear
was,
earplugs for Fish too?
I do. I do. I'll sometimes, if, you know, I'll pull them out if it's a quiet part. But for the most part, I have these special kind of wax ones that I can hear around. They're not like completely obstructive.
Yeah.
They just bring down the decibels.
That's good.
And when you guys are 53, you'll do the same. Yeah. I promise.
I wear them for everything, but not for Fish.
Okay.
Yeah, I need it all.
Well, I pull them out for like Karina.
That was awesome last night.
That song might just be called Karina.
Yeah, Karina.
That's a different Bob Dylan song.
Bob Dylan song. Freewheeling.
So I've seen it mislabeled, or else maybe just in my head I've mislabeled.
Yeah.
But that was a beautiful version last night.
Yeah,
so
it
of
was.
Course
so
my earplugs were out for that.
Nice.
So what I was getting to was Dan invited me and Trey and Kuroda was doing lights, and so we were standing on this platform.
And
next
your
to,
daughter and Anna came.
Oh, yeah, and my daughter Anna was there, and before we knew it, I mean, I didn't know a whole heck of a lot of Justin Bieber songs, but Dan made a special welcome for us by incorporating Fish licks, at least six of them, into the concert.
Yeah.
I heard, from what I remember, Maze and Sand.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
is that right?
I mean, that sounds about right.
And I think you did the Down With The Disease.
Yeah, we do that a lot.
Can you remember any others offhand?
I used to do 2001 a lot in there. It was a challenge every show to see, you know, which ones I could sneak in.
Is that something that someone might, you know, be offended by? Treating it as a joke in a way? Or is that something that Justin was completely thrilled about and it happened?
Oh, he was really cool about it. I mean, we had this one. It started with this video transition for a song where I made this instrumental to go with this video piece while he was changing. And it was just sort of this thing looping in A. And I was sort of, you know, just jamming over it. And then I figured out, well, I could fit Sand over it. And then I started doing it kind of as a joke just to make Kuroda laugh. And then one night I did it and Chris, like, popped the light over my head with a dent. And I saw the lights going and I could see him laughing, and then from there, you know, we just kept doing it. But Justin knew what was going on and he thought it was great, and I mean, he understood at that point, you know, the Fish community and how it was sort of interesting to them, and you know, at that time for him, I think he was really looking to show people, you know, especially like other, not his fans, but other fans, that he is a very serious musician and things like that. So, I mean, he felt, I think, that it was actually mature and really fun and fishy. He kind of understood that it was fishy. But
well, that was great. Well, Trey was delighted. Every time every time we recognized you doing that, we looked at each other and we're like squealing, you know, like the rest of the 14-year-old girls there.
Yeah. Mike came to a show with his family once. This is a funny one that I remember in Jersey. And so did all these Victoria's Secret models. They're all there at the same show. And so... So during that song, I played a lot of teases, I remember, and Justin called me down to his little quick change room, and I came down the stairs and, you know, into his little closed dressing room. Uh-huh. He's changing and putting on this, like, studded whatever, and he's like, are you playing more Fish teases because Mike's here tonight? And I was like, are you, like, thrusting your hips a little more because there's 10 Victoria's Secret models? And he's like, you know it, Dan.
So same answer, right?
Yeah.
that's phenomenal. So Dan and I are now set up in the second studio, and we're actually in Trey's backstage Madison Square Garden room.
Yeah.
And it's quite nice.
It's quite nice.
There's a guitar staring
there is
at
a
us.
Guitar
Dan has
right
resisted
there.
The urge to grab it and start playing, which I'm glad he has. There's
I don't
a cool
think it's
amp, too. Dan immediately examined the ant as well. But it occurred to me, Dan, that I forgot to ask you an important question that I was going to ask you, is that you had played on stage with Mike and John Fishman at one point. Can you tell us how that happened and what transpired?
Yeah, sure. It was in Chicago, the year of the Harpua the Right Way. And, you know, the first night it got canceled halfway through the show. There was like a crazy rainstorm.
Right.
During set break. And then
is that an indoor-outdoor venue?
Outdoor.
Oh, okay.
And then they came on, I think they played Disease, pretty sure. And then they said, sorry, we have to, or during Caspian maybe, something. Okay. They had to cancel.
They got a few songs out and then
quit. Yeah, Caspian, actually.
So shortest Fish concert ever, maybe?
Maybe. I'm sure Biz Archive could tell you on Twitter.
Definitely.
And anyway, so my wife and I and my brother-in-law, Jack, had a plan to go with Mike to see some blues acts after the show. So we were backstage and the show ended and we went on his bus and we went to these blues bars. It was amazing. Saw some incredible players. And then he told me that he was meeting up with Fishman at Second City to do this improv set, and they needed a guitar player. Would I be interested in playing guitar?
So to paint the picture a little bit more detailed, this is, when you say an improv set, you're talking about in front of a live audience.
In front of a live audience at Second City, Chicago.
And you were unrehearsed?
This is like 1 a.m.
You were completely unrehearsed?
Yeah. Oh, entirely. And we so we got there and we met the cast, who were all wonderful, such sweet people. I mean, that's probably why they invited them to do the Harpua, because they're just hilarious and great people.
Right.
And we went on stage and we it started, you know, someone would shout out something like they would in improv. So they would say, you know, horny. And then we would have to play this like 4-minute horny, you know, jam inspired by the word horny, and I, you know, and then we'd quiet down and the cast would come out and do a skit.
Horny, I'm thinking like there's a wah-wah involved.
You know, and it was a blast, you know, it was such an amazing opportunity, and, you know, I was laughing for a lot of it, but it wasn't lost on me that, I, you know, how exciting it was to play with Mike and Fish, and just to see how tight they are.
I mean, oh, yeah.
As a rhythm section. And I've noticed that every time I listen to Fish, but to actually be playing and soloing over them, it was just unreal.
Must have been delightful.
You know, their connection that they have.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Years and years of playing together.
Oh, my gosh.
And then suddenly you were able to sort of build upon that foundation.
Yeah, I mean, it helped because we were just, everything was so off the cuff.
Right.
You know, at least they.
In a way, though, like, you know, despite, no matter how great they are, you were the melody. Like, you had to come up with stuff off the cuff.
Yeah, which was fun.
Well, maybe you're good at that sort of thing.
But those guys
awesome.
Are, you know,
that's
really, awesome. I guess they're off the cuff anyway. I mean, I've heard through the grapevine that they don't know any of the songs going on stage.
Now, that's
right?
Funny. We can ask, you know, Trey when he shows up.
Yeah.
That kind of thing, if we stray from the topic of guitars, because that's something, the set list itself is,
oh my gosh,
is a topic for exploration.
So many questions.
But the way
that,
in my mind, is that, and I'm not 100% sure of this, now that you say it, but I have a feeling that Mike and Fish don't know the songs before Trey tells them on stage.
Yeah.
Which is pretty intense.
So being in a, you know, at Second City, just improv, they were very comfortable. They
that
were
was
in
easy
their
for
own
them.
Space.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. Well, I'm going to press pause here and wait for Trey to
I'm
show
gonna
up.
I'm going to stare at the guitar and pick it up.
he's inching closer on the couch to the guitar. And we should say for the record, which guitar?
It's Old Reliable, number one.
It's number one with the middle.
Single coil in
single
the middle.
Single coil, yeah. So this is the Grateful Dead 50 guitar.
That is the GD50 guitar, totally.
All right. There you have it. This is part two of the deep dive into Trey's guitars. And we're sitting here, Dan and I, with, of course, Trey Anastasia. Thank you for inviting us into your...
Thank you for having me on your podcast. I'm a huge fan.
Yeah, well, thank
of
you.
Of everything about you. I have been for years. I think I'm your oldest fan.
What did you say?
I was your fan in fourth grade.
What did you were. What did you say about me when you welcomed me onto stage as Bruce Springsteen? Like,
oh my god,
one of my favorite influences as a New Jersey songwriter. Jeez. It was really great.
Oh, you had to remind me of that. That was like another inside joke backstage that we didn't have the wisdom to leave backstage. We thought it would be just as funny. We were laughing so hard backstage. We thought it would be just as funny to everyone else, including all of the crew guys and local crew hands and maintenance guys from New Jersey. Somehow, once again, probably interpreted that as us making fun of Bruce Springsteen, who we both idolize.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. It wasn't that at all.
It wasn't that at all.
I'm wondering, as soon as it started, I thought...
Why did I do that? Why did we do
this? That used to happen more. I think our filter has become better.
Yeah.
I mean, because like, even that... Oh, I don't even want to bring this one up. There's so many of them that I cringe.
Give me a hint.
Even that, you know... song playing over and over on the radio, Shine.
Oh,
which
right.
I still feel bad about.
I mean, we were just talking
about that.
That's one of his favorite bands.
I love
that song. We both were like, you know, rocking out to it and singing it in the car on the stereo, and it wasn't supposed to be. The joke backstage, it used to happen so quickly, regularly,
right.
that we'd be laughing backstage and we would just go right on stage and do one of those things.
Right.
The Bruce Springsteen one is a perfect example.
That is, right.
Where he had a multiple show run.
And
somewhere,
he had a break.
And he had a night off.
Yeah, he was in New Jersey at the Meadowlands.
He was at the Meadowlands.
Yeah, and he had a night off, and it was perfect for you to say, and I think they sowed the seeds earlier among the, there was a group videoing, and they were attached to the, this was at the time called Garden State Arts Center.
Right.
The stagehands. So the rumor was rife that Bruce Springsteen could possibly be a visitor
tomorrow night. We showed up for sound check, and everybody was like, "Oh, I hear Bruce is going to sit in tonight." And we're like, "Yeah, right, sure,
or whatever." Tom, you and spread some seeds.
We were just laughing.
And then
we were in the band room, and I started riffing on, "Ladies and gentlemen, my favorite New Jersey songwriter. Yeah, I grew up loving his music.
This guy influenced me
in the course of my life. You know, he's a musician, a songwriter who changed the course of my life, probably more than any other."
And then you said, Ladies and gentlemen, New Jersey's favorite son,
Tom Marshall.
He's contributed through my whole life. And he also, of course, is a New Jersey native and somebody that's really excited for him. That's right. One of the great songwriters of New Jersey's favorite son, ladies and gentlemen. Tom Marshall, ladies and gentlemen.
Not cool.
It was so funny backstage.
It was all right. I pulled off an okay version of.
I remember looking at the. The local Jersey stagehands.
They're pissed.
And that's realizing that they didn't get.
No, they didn't.
You know, it was kind of three levels of humor that
why would they ever get it?
And they were kind of grimacing with their arms crossed.
Right. And there's another reason for the grimace. So the night before. I had overplayed my welcome. What's it called? I had overextended the power of the all access pass.
Probably in the case of beer.
Well, no. So I brought.
So
there's a case of beer in this story. Is that what you said?
There isn't.
A thing of water fell from above because.
I heard about that.
Yeah, so I went. So basically, I took two of my friends. We were standing in the audience watching a great fish show. This was the night before Bruce Springsteen. And my friend looked up behind us and saw this spot where there's some spotlights.
Yeah.
And I said, "Oh yeah, I can get us up there." So we went up.
Yeah.
And this was.
And you showed your pass to get up there.
This was actually right at set break. We went up, and yeah, I had to all access my way up. And it actually wasn't the easiest way up. It was sort of like stairs for a while, and then it became like a ladder and a hatch, and then. There's a reason they don't want people there is because it was sort of this weird slatted floor where you could thread cables down to the stage if you needed to, and it was sort of treacherous, and there were spools of high tension cable everywhere holding all the shit up.
Yeah.
above the band. I mean, like, so many reasons not to be up there. And out of my friend's back pocket slipped a thing of water, and it landed on stage next to a crew member, one of the local guys. Mm-hmm. And so long story short, we snuck down, kind of, or my two friends snuck down before the encore, and I stayed. And then by the time I went down, they grabbed me, and they really grabbed me. And they were, because one of my friends got away clean. The next one sort of had to wiggle away. And by the time I came down, they like were fucking ready. And they, I don't know what they were going to do to me, but they were dragging me toward sort of the bus area.
Yeah.
And Brad stepped in.
Wow.
Brad kind of walked in. It was amazing. I was so grateful for him at that moment, because I felt I was being dragged to be pounded.
Like, you might have been.
To be beaten up. And
that's probably payback for all the times you got away. Because you, in the past, it was like karmic payback. Because you, more than any of my other friends when we were growing up, used to always get escape. Away with stuff that anyone else would have gotten caught. What?
But I never karmically left anyone.
I always got caught.
I never left anyone for a pounding.
Like, no, but that pounding was like, you know, karmic revenge for all the times that you got away. Because you always got away, and I always got caught for anything we did. Like, I couldn't lie my way out of a paper bag or whatever. And the best one was when we were in, like, middle school, I think, or middle school, like early high school or something, eighth, ninth grade, and you were walking through the hallway. And you used to always do this thing. Tom used to always do this thing where it was like this little game that was played whenever we would walk by the fire alarm. He would go, like, sort of tap it with his hands and go like, ah, and like tap the fire alarm. And then, you know, because pulling the fire alarm was something you never did.
Yeah, I know.
And he wouldn't pull it. He would just kind of tap on
it.
He'd rattle the fire alarm, like, ah, and we'd all laugh and walk by. So one time, he was walking by the fire alarm, and he just like went, digga digga digga, and rattled it, and it just fell open.
This particular one didn't have a spring.
Yeah.
It just actually fell open.
It just fell open, and it was like, bam, 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 the fire alarm's off. And then fire trucks came, and the whole school's emptied out, and the fire guys are walking through the school. Big, huge, you know, at that age, that's not really something you do. And it was like an immediate suspension or expulsion or something for pulling the fire alarm. And Tom pulled the fire alarm. He didn't mean to, but how you can explain that?
Right.
Apparently there were some kids in the lower school who saw him do it. So
they saw a tall guy with glasses, thank God. And I didn't back then have glasses. They said a tall guy with glasses.
But everyone in the school knew it was you. This is the part that amazes me. And let me, because this will say so much about you, I'll add to your podcast. This is the part that amazes me. Everybody knew it was Tom. So it was over. They let everybody back in, and they called Tom into the office the next day. And, you know, it was the headmaster and the assistant headmaster and all these, like, top people. And they're like, okay, we knew you did it. You got two choices. You either admit it right now and you'll be suspended, or you don't admit it and you're going to be expelled. And Tom was like, I didn't do it. Just right?
Yeah.
Like, didn't they keep calling you back
it's
in there?
It's basically like that,
And just grilling you? They're like, we know you did it, like, and now you're expelled. Yeah. So it...
Yeah, well, it was like never the headmaster, but the headmaster's son, like right before I went in, said, we know you did it. Like,
oh.
Yeah, but then the headmaster himself said, Tom, we've narrowed it down to maybe possibly four people, and you're obviously, you're in the running.
Yeah,
you know, big time in the running. And I just kind of, somewhere in my head, had I come out early and said I accidentally did this, it would have been great. But after now a week investigation of saying it wasn't me, I just finally couldn't backtrack on that. So I just had to go.
I remember that.
Bold-faced lie.
The horror was palpable at the time.
It was
everybody
horrible.
Knew. I remember like going, like, everyone knew you did it. And you just kept going in and saying, I didn't do it. You can't prove it. Well, and they couldn't.
I didn't say you can't prove it. I just said I didn't do it. Like, you know, that was because I knew it was down to about four people and no one could really pin down their whereabouts.
And eventually it
faded.
Ended.
It faded. And I didn't get expelled.
Nothing happened.
Nothing happened.
Hopefully they don't listen to your podcast.
Lied your way out.
Neither, yeah. Don't
and
listen.
In contrast, after I went to the next school, there was this Chinese history class that I was in, and the professor, who was the headmaster, it was seniors only, like pre-college, like high level, whatever. And he used to walk out of the room and let everybody, and do the, you know, hand out a test and walk out of the room. And somewhere near the end, right when college applications were going in and stuff like that, one day he came and he said, we're going to do one more test. And it was a surprise test, and everybody was all upset. And he walked out of the room. And the entire class, except maybe one person, like one girl, just opened up their books and started like blatantly cheating. Around, we used to sit around a table, and everyone was like just blatantly cheating.
Right.
And I joined in with the cheating side, and they were like, maybe two people didn't cheat.
Right.
So, like, a couple of weeks later, we went to class, we sat down, the headmaster walked in, shut the door.
Oh, no.
And he said, we know what happened, we're taking you one by one into my office before you even have a chance to talk about what happened, and everybody who cheated is going to be expelled.
Oh my God, right? Expelled.
Yeah, it was. So I went in there just like you did, and they said, we know you did it. And I was just like, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I did it. And I just, you know. Like,
you broke too soon.
I can't lie like that. I don't know.
You can't.
So, I, you know, okay. Then after it was all, I just assumed everybody was busted. When it was over, there were two other people out of like 14
that said they did it,
who had confessed. Wow. And the three of us got, we didn't get expelled. We got suspended, and we had to come over vacation and do maintenance work. It was like a big deal.
You got in major
everybody
trouble.
Else, everybody who lied just got off.
Skated.
And everybody who caved in.
So what lesson do you find in that?
I learned that to try to be a better liar. Tell your children, parents. Seriously.
Oh no.
You better learn how
Dan
to lie.
Dan has young kids now.
Teach them.
Yeah. You've given me lots of good advice about parenhood. This is not
and that's
one
what
of those
that song is.
This
about.
Isn't one of those.
That's what Let Me Lie is about.
Let Me Lie.
Now you know. You think it's about a bike.
Yeah.
But it's not.
Oh my God. Wow. To get back to the podcast topic.
Okay.
Which I'd love to, I would love to do. I'd love to talk forever about stuff like this.
Yeah.
I think that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
We really do. We have a lot of questions for you regarding guitars.
Ready.
And your guitar, it kind of, as far as Paul Languedoc goes, it started right with the guitar you're holding right now.
Well, it started before that.
Time Guitars.
Mm-hmm. Paul worked for a company called Time Guitars. It wasn't his company. And I'm going to say right now, and I'll probably say it again, hey, Paul, if you're listening, if I get anything wrong, my apologies. I love Paul.
Well, I should.
I always loved Paul. He was my roommate, and I'll tell you all that. So I'll do the best that I can to get it as accurate as possible.
Really quickly, since you brought that up, let me just mention that Dan and I fully intend, if Paul wants us to talk to him. And in fact, we wanted to do such a deep dive that we thought we would work our way up to you, and then suddenly just learned that, well, why don't you just talk to Trey?
Right, yeah.
But I don't want to miss Paul in that process at
all. Great. Well, so Paul was around Burlington, and he worked for a company called Time Guitars. Shortly after I got there in the early 80s, let me get this straight. I bought a Time guitar. So if you listen to some of the really early Phish, there's the white tape, the white album, has this sort of Strat sounding guitar on it. That was a Time guitar. It's a very Strat-y sounding.
Three-quarter scale guitar. Yeah.
Wicked Chicka kind of Strat. No, that's not that. Oh. This was a Strat.
That, and this is after your Ibanez?
I had an Ibanez, which
first?
I loved.
Was that your first guitar?
I had, when I was in high school, my first guitar.
Yeah.
I'll just go right to the beginning. When I started learning guitar, I learned classical guitar first, which was a great thing. That was, and so my first guitar was a rented classical nylon string.
Yeah.
And that was great, you know, that I had a great guitar teacher, and he was like, listen, you should learn classical guitar before you ever even think about getting an electric guitar. So I learned Bach Gavotte's finger style, and it was a rented nylon string that, you know, like a student guitar.
Sure.
And then I wanted an electric guitar, and I got an Ibanez sort of Sunburst. Okay,
when
I
was Les Paul style.
That was a Les Paul style guitar, and it was a musician, Ibanez musician.
Right, yeah. I remember it well.
That was a great guitar.
And why? Why that guitar?
I can't remember. It was kind of
like two humbuckers. Like
two humbuckers. Is it like? Yeah. I didn't know enough then to know any better.
Yeah.
To be perfectly honest, I'm just trying to really do the. I think I went to a music store, and it was probably, I didn't have a very limited budget at the time. Uh-huh. I'm sure my parents were probably helping me, and they probably said you could spend 100 and whatever.
Yeah.
I remember that guitar from Princeton Day School era.
Yeah.
And Steve remembers it from Taft era.
I had it at Taft.
It came up to Taft with me.
When Steve and I were in a band called Red Tide at Taft, and that's the Dude of Life, Steve. I met you at PDS. Where I went up through 10th grade. So we were friends from 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, all that. And then when I went to a different school, Taft, I met the dude, Steve. So you guys didn't actually know each other.
Correct.
Until years later.
And we just covered this in a podcast.
Right.
Yeah.
Which makes me so happy, like, that you guys became friends is, like, the coolest thing.
He left out Red Tide. He jumped right to Space Antelope.
It was originally called Red Tide.
Okay.
And Steve wasn't really in it at first.
Okay.
When I got there, I had the Red Ibanez, and the band was called Red Tide. And we did Police, Lou Reed, you know, songs like Vicious, You Hit Me With a Flower. It was a great band. And we did Low Spark of High Heel Boys. And I want to say one more thing, and you can edit this in. So I got this Red Ibanez on 48th Street in New York. And when I was about 15 years old, I started taking guitar lessons from a guy in Manhattan. So my mom would let me take the train. I just took the train into Times Square.
Wow.
Once a week.
Oh, cool.
And I went to 48th Street and got the Ibanez. And this guy was sort of over by the plaza. So I would walk through Times Square. And part of the reason I'm saying that is because that was... I was born in 64, so that would be 1979. Wow. And you remember what Times Square was like back then?
Was it kind of seedier?
It was all like porno and stores. Drug dealers and prostitutes walking around. It was crazy in the 70s. Huh. I just remember I loved it. I loved coming into the city to take my guitar lessons and walk through Times Square and look at all these...
That's why you knew the city so well. Like, of all our friends, I was kind of, like, afraid of the city.
It was kind of crazy back then.
When I was with you, or Peter Cotone, I always felt like you guys were good tour guides.
My mom, you know, grew up in the city.
Oh, okay.
Like, she went to high school at PS6 on the east side. And she's a lifetime New Yorker. So she always encouraged me to go into the city from a very young age. And I took these guitar lessons as about 15 years old.
Nice.
And I bought that Ibanez.
Okay.
They gave me money or something, or I had a summer job or something like that.
Right. The funny thing is, so that was sort of invisible to a lot of your friends. And a lot of them, if you ask them, kind of don't remember how all of a sudden you went from drummer to guitarist.
Right.
And that's kind of funny. There's like this transition, like boom, suddenly Trey knew how to play guitar. But there were classical lessons. There was hidden New York lessons.
Right.
Awesome.
I used to play a lot. I practiced a lot too.
You sure did.
A lot. So I just really liked playing the guitar at an early age. And
who were your early guitar heroes?
My early guitar heroes? That's a really good question. Well, number one by far was Jimmy Page, which sort of, I don't know why, it kind of, that when I do interviews with guitar mags and stuff, that gets forgotten. Tom might remember that I had something like 50 Led Zeppelin posters in my room. My whole entire room was, this is when I was like 12.
Yeah.
It was all Led Zeppelin posters. And my first job, I worked at the Princeton Record Exchange, and I worked for records. And that guy used to call the guy who owns the Princeton Record Exchange, which is now a big store. Mm-hmm. At the time, it was me and him. I was the only employee, and I would stack records and stuff like that. And he would give me Led Zeppelin bootlegs, and he used to call me Led Zeppelin. He's like, "Hey, Led Zeppelin, here's another bootleg. Now clean, like sweep the floor." Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that was the number one influence, without question, for quite some time. And then Steve Howe.
Yeah.
You know, I love Yes. We used to listen to those, you know, Santana.
Yeah.
You know, Dwayne, all those guys. Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
Disraeli Gears was one of the first records I ever bought. Cream, you know, and this is again still at 440 Walnut Lane. So this was when, this is pre, we moved to the new house in like sixth grade.
Yeah.
So this is like fourth or fifth grade.
Right.
I had Disraeli
Gears. Well, I remember you, to me, the Dwayne, like, yes, in terms of what you listened to.
Yeah.
Totally Zeppelin is what I remember.
Right.
But in terms of how you played, I always felt there was some sort of Southern Dwayne-y thing happening there.
I listened to, like, a lot of Fillmore's
record. Because even like I Am Hydrogen, one of our earliest things, that's Dwayne. To me, you were in a Dwayne kick.
Right? Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
And again, it's, I don't know why that doesn't
Blue
come
Sky,
up anymore.
You're playing that song, Blue Sky, over and over and over again.
I used to listen to, somehow, maybe I got it from, maybe my parents had it or something, but I got the Fillmore East record at some point.
Cool. Oh, wow.
And
Eat a Peach, you had.
Yep. Sweet. So those guys and
from the Ibanez.
So anyway, so I got that Ibanez, and then I went to I went to Taft, and we had this band Red Tide,
right?
Which eventually,
Steve started.
Steve kind of joined in, and we kind of, it was like a bunch of people, and then it sort of morphed into, right when we were seniors, it sort of morphed into our band, and it became the Space Antelope thing.
Nice.
It was cool, though, when I, there's still people who have tapes. That band was, for a high school band, not so bad. We played some, we played Rush.
Wow.
We used to play, like, the drummer was really into Neil Peart, and played Rush songs, and it was, like, pretty all over the map.
Dan's playing Limelight with...
I'm interviewing Alex.
Wow. He would be on my list. I used to listen to those guys a lot. I mean, it's weird. Yeah. I listen to everything. I didn't have a lot of...
Yeah.
I mean, I still kind of do, but I really listen to everything. I didn't have a... I never had a genre that I was...
Yeah, I mean, every time we've talked, you're into, like, musicals, D'Angelo, this, that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's still like that. I mean, and it, you know,
I can't keep up with Travis ever. I never have been able to musically.
Yeah.
I is it because, although I don't think you're not, let me rephrase what I'm trying to say. I, when I hear someone, I dive so deeply into them that I feel like I exclude others. Whereas you listen to everyone, and yet I think you're not doing surface dives either. You're doing deep dives, but just into way, way more people.
Right.
I don't know how you have the time for that.
I mean, I still love listening to music. I still listen to music a lot.
Yeah.
So.
You also always had, Trey had this amazing ability of kind of listening to a song once, and even when we're writing, and knowing the lyrics and knowing the songs and the changes. Like, that was sort of like this almost supernatural ability you've always kind of had.
Thank God, now that we have.
Intense.
300 and whatever. It's very strange too when, if you try to remember that stuff.
Yeah.
If I try to remember it, I forget it.
Well, that brings to mind a set list question that I don't even know the answer to. I wonder if we even want to go here. But do you write a set list? Show it to Paige. You kind of come up with a set list before a concert. Show a couple song ideas to Paige and then throw it away.
Yeah, well, I don't write a set list. What I write it, what I do is, here's exactly what I do.
I think it's interesting. Let's hear it.
It is. Well, you'll see in front of you that on the table. That's every single song Fish plays, including covers, some of which we haven't played in 20 years and stuff like that.
So there might be 400
songs. So when I wake up in the morning, this whole thing is habitual, and it's kind of been, because we're the band that talks about everything, there've been many, many conversations about, do you want me to do this, you know, with the guys? And yes, they want me to do it. And I'm not overstepping any bounds or anything, right? But it's, so I wake up in the morning and I have my coffee and I read through the song list, the whole song list. And I circle songs without thinking, just really like mixing the coffee and drinking and...
And you're not worried about, like, whether Fish played this song last time we were here? You're not doing that kind of analysis?
No.
Yet. Okay.
Unless Well, unless somebody, you know, unless I'm talking to you or one of my friends or something, and they're like, oh, I was in the parking lot and everybody wants to hear X. Oh,
okay.
Then I'll put that down.
Colonel Forbin.
So then I circle all these songs, and it ends up being, I did it right before I came here tonight because we were talking back at Madison Square Garden backstage, and it ends up being about like 100 songs.
Wow.
Now, some of the choices are because I know, because I'm in constant contact with the other guys, you know, like, oh, let's play Mound. And then Paige says, can you give me like a week on Mound because I'm with my kids and I don't want to mess it up again. And I'm going to if I don't practice it. It's, wow. The middle of Mound is really hard.
Yes.
And he says, can you take that one off the list, please?
Ah.
So then I take it off the list. Or Fish says, I'd love to do Demand, but the drum part is a written part. I really need a couple days. Or sometimes it's even simpler songs that, you know, I wanted to do, I circled, not too long ago, I circled, what's that song that Mike sings? Zither, Rachel, Cardamom?
Mock Frost? Song.
Yeah.
That's Mock Song, I think.
Mock Song. Yeah. I love that song.
Yeah.
It's like one of my favorite Mike
That's
songs.
That's a great song.
And
yeah.
Mike kind of said, you know, I'd really like to know the lyrics.
That one's hard to get the lyrics right.
Yeah, he's just like, I'm going to forget the lyrics. Can you just not put that on the list? So it gets crossed off.
Right.
Scyther, Rachel, Cardamom, Frost. But at what cost? Threshold skin, fortress wind. A life of sin, pliers, tension, toy store grace. The human race, breaking 14 basket screw.
So then the list ends up being about, it's like a whole page with small font, right?
Yeah.
It's not 300, but it's 80 for the night.
Right.
And I quickly text that or email it to Richard, our tour manager. So then when I arrive at the venue, he hands me that. And we go up on stage for soundcheck. And then at soundcheck, I'm kind of like, well, you guys like these? Or, you know, what do you... And then we'll say, oh, I really want to do Waking Up Dead, but I really don't want to do it unless we run it. So, for instance, last night I said, oh, let's do Home, the new song by Paige.
Yes.
Which I love.
Right.
And then we forgot to run it in soundcheck.
Okay.
And then it was on the list for last night. And he came into my band room, and he's like, I don't want to do that unless we run it. I don't want to go up and mess up Home.
Okay, good.
So could you just take it off?
Right.
And it goes off. So there's a dialogue happening, but at the same time, it's...
But you're still maintaining the list.
Yeah. Okay. Then when I walk on stage, I go on... Probably by the time we go on stage for the first set, it's probably down to like 30.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Even though the rule is, of course, everything is fair game. So... We walk on stage at 30, but we make 100% sure to not know what song we're going to start with when we walk on.
Oh, my God.
There's ideas, but and this has become much easier than... I can't even plan it anymore. It's too much thinking and too much work. But so it's kind of like almost like martial arts in the sense that we go on stage without a set list, but that's not really exactly true.
Okay.
What happens is that there's a lot of...
There's thinking behind the scenes.
Discussion in order to forget. Like,
that's
you know,
so
we don't just go on with nothing.
Right.
You know what I mean? But that's kind of... That system has developed over years where, you know, we'll go to catering or something and there'll be like 30 and four copies get sent to the band members.
Okay.
And Paige might walk by and be like, oh my God, I love that song.
Okay.
And then I register that in my mind. Oh, Paige loves that song. Good. Or, you know what I mean?
Right.
Or, you know, Mike says, you know, or if, you know, I'm like, Ass Handed. And Fish is like, oh, I want to sing Ass Handed. So now I know. So I'm still sort of the one who...
You're maintaining the master copy in a way.
In my mind, partially in my mind. Like those little comments stick in the back of my mind.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
And then we go on stage and I just forget. So then last night we were playing some jam and we're just... And like all of a sudden we were like in F.
And yeah.
And which is simple. Yeah. And simple wasn't like on the list or anything. Like no list.
It's just answered.
But we were just playing it. Yeah. So then now you're playing simple. So then most of the decisions are made based on what you just played before.
Yeah.
Like if you did a big blah, blah, blah song, like then it usually feels like, oh, I got to sing something. And then it's very obvious what the next song's supposed to be.
Nice.
So there's like a process during the day, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But the process leads to as much improv in the song list as...
Right.
Sometimes somebody's got on a sign. A lot of times, the sign thing only works... The sign thing usually works like a day later.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Again, because...
It's because you have already put in a little bit of thinking.
The songs that trip you up now are the simple ones.
Right.
Funnily enough,
okay.
It's not necessarily It's Ice that throws you.
Oh.
Even though It's Ice was easier when we played it more often.
Is that because like a Brian and Robert or Dirt? Exactly.
Or
they sound very easy and you kind of put them in the back of your head like, oh yeah, we know that.
And then you get to the B section and you're like, is there a B section? Or somebody's kind of like, what? The simpler ones are kind of without running them once.
Right. Yeah.
And people's lives are busy, so.
Yep.
Do you ever stack two songs because you know you're going to end, let's say, in D, and then you could go right into...
No.
Runaway, you know.
I did.
Yeah.
Earlier, like in 95 or... I used to be much more... Like, when we started playing Four Nights at the Garden, uh-huh. I planned the whole thing out.
Mm.
And just because it was too overwhelming.
Yeah.
The idea of not repeating songs for that amount of time.
Yeah.
And also not, like, saving all the good ones for one, accidentally saving all the good ones for one show or
exactly.
something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
But.
Yeah. And what are good ones? What does that mean?
That's the other thing. Is that I will tell you another little trick about that that's kind of funny is that I used to have a part of my brain that would save, like, have a, oh, we've got three more nights here, let's save a big song. This is like about 5 years ago or something, after We Kind of Came Back, I realized that if you just keep it in one set, and it's like, we're going to play the best songs tonight. This is going to write the best song for the moment.
Yeah.
The next couple nights end up being even better. Like,
mm-hmm.
there is no best song.
It's
exactly what you're saying. As a matter of fact, it's kind of counterintuitive.
Yeah. Yeah, it's sort of the opposite of
it's the opposite.
The
like, oh, this is the big song.
Fish.
We're going to play the big song.
Yeah.
And then you know? It's not the big song that was actually the big song.
That's
and it's
that's
everybody's kind of. It's pretty mysterious. I'm not trying to be like hippie guy or anything, but it is mysterious. And it's like, you know. There's a way to get to a point where the no thinking thing, though I'm talking about writing,
yeah,
I try to keep that all the way back to the beginning of that story with the coffee. Like, I don't know why. I'm just kind of go whoosh, 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 really quickly and before I can think about it, circling these songs on the list.
You've always tried to pull from some other, from the ether, your ideas, whether it's a set list.
Or when we're songwriting.
Or it's a new song.
Right.
So you're getting those kind of from the same place.
That's just like staying in the moment and just kind of, because it feels right.
Well,
I don't know.
It works, and it's as much of being an artist as writing a song or playing a song.
Probably.
Is coming up with the right order to make the shows work.
Like, I love...
You have a theory about this?
No, I just have... I know we're supposed to talk about guitars, but I have another question about set list. Do you... When you're playing a new song...
Yeah.
Which I think, even though this is a different type of audience, you know, it still, I would say, challenges the audience more than, like, a old classic song.
Yeah.
Do you consciously try to ever sandwich... Like, when I see Elton John, for example, he'll play, you know, Benny and the Jets.
And then
he'll
a new
say,
song.
Hey, here's a new song. And then after the new song, he's like, thanks for listening to that. Here's Tiny Dancer.
I don't feel that way.
No.
I get what you're saying. That's a good question. I really don't feel that way. I feel more...
Or are they all just even playing?
Well, I mean, like... Maybe it's from... Like, our problem has been too many available songs, not it's not a problem. But I love new songs, and as Tom will attest, here we are together, but we love writing together, and I love writing, and so, like, what's a new song? Like, right now, you know, Blaze On or No Men or you know, Fuego, or I suppose those are new songs, but they feel the freshest to me, and I like them so much. I know the other guys do.
Yeah.
A lot. We like playing those songs a lot right now. Mm-hmm. And so I don't feel the element to the story that you just told is an element of apology. Thanks for listening.
Yeah.
I don't feel that at all.
That's great.
Not at all. Uh-huh. I also kind of feel like I'm sure Elton John is in a different situation where his fans, you know, probably see him once in their life.
Yeah.
If not twice. You know, he being, you know, the greatest, one of the greatest songwriters of all time, and somebody that I absolutely just adore and idolize his music. Same. But
you're right,
when I walk on stage,
I
see a lot of the same people, and I feel like I'm walking into a room full of friends.
Totally.
I mean, really, you were there last night. I mean, I know so many people that were there last night.
Yeah.
And so I know. I mean, how many times have you seen you, Tom, you know, Mike's song?
At least 50
times.
Yeah.
And like, in contrast, you're going to see Elton John. How many times have you seen Elton John?
Zero, which is exactly your point.
I've seen him zero, too, and I really want to.
I really want to.
Wow. One day I will see him.
Me too.
And when I do, I really hope he plays some of Saved My Life tonight.
Nice.
Because I love that song.
Yeah. And
that'll be great.
Yeah.
So he's got a different situation than me.
You're right.
And even in the world of like bands that kind of, you know, like improvisational rock bands, I have a friend of mine who's a huge Allman Brothers fan, and he finally got to see the Allman Brothers at the Beacon.
Huh.
And I said, "How was it?" And he said, "They didn't play Whipping Post, and I just wanted to see Whipping Post." I kept going, "Whipping Post!" I was kind of like, "Well, they probably played like 28 straight nights, you know, they might have played it." But he's like, "I know, but I've been wanting to see them my whole life, and they didn't play Whipping Post."
I'm happy to hear that you don't think like that.
Oh, man.
For me,
the opposite.
Working in the pot world, I think why I got so heavy into Phish was the opposite of that. There's so much thought and overanalyzing, and, you know, these devices that, like, work, and I totally agree. When Elton John does that, it feels to me almost like more of an apology than he's proud of the song.
I feel like
I'm happy to hear you don't do that.
Yeah. No, not at all. Actually, what I'm looking forward to, what I look forward to more is to have. We used to do these shows with Phish. They're some of my favorite shows. There are at least three of them that I can remember, where we played like 14 new songs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there's one in Lowell at this pro-choice benefit or something.
Yeah, who was there? It was a woman was there.
Oh,
she turned out to be a fan of Theme from the Bottom.
Gloria Steinem.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Gloria
was there. And I think we did one in Providence once where we played like six songs from Rift. And
cool.
The difference between those are my favorite shows.
Yeah.
And I'll say another thing. I did a show up in Vermont once. It was called the 8-Foot Fluorescent Tubes. And it was the opening night of Higher Ground Club, or opening weekend. I think there might have been 2 weeks. So Kevin Staitzer, who started that club, asked me if I would play the first Saturday night. And I said, sure, but it's got to be a whole new band with a new name, and I want to write all new music. And he said, okay. So we came out, and there was this band, this put together band. It was Russ and Tony and
Tom.
You know, Tom Lawson, and a lot of your lyrics, Tom, and then a lot of songs that were written with, you know, like me and Russ. And it was First Tube was the first song, because it was the 8-Foot Fluorescent Tube, so that was the first time we ever played. It was the First Tube was the opening song of the Tube concert, and we had props, and it was like a show. Right, there was like a curtain with lights and dancers who had 8-foot fluorescent tubes in their hands, plugged in
behind the sheets at first, and then the sheets popped open. Yeah,
and then the sheets popped open when it goes major.
Yeah.
It was so cool. And then we did Sand for the first time ever.
Oh yeah,
that was the first time that ever got played.
Yes,
and all these other songs, And that was so fun to me. And maybe it's coming from a, you know, a family that went and saw, you know, like shows in New York, theatrical shows, and you go in, you don't know what you're going to see. So I like playing new songs.
Yeah.
You ready, ready for a segue? You guys in the podcasting world? What guitar were you playing there, Trey?
Okay. I will tell you that. I'll finish this sentence and then we'll go right into this.
Sorry.
What I look forward to is a little more time to rehearse. Right?
Yeah.
So, as you know, there's always a lot of new songs. And what we used to have with Fish that's a little more precious today is we live together. And so we could rehearse and we could go out and play Foam or something like that. Now everybody's kind of in their lives and it's a lot harder. Now here's an interesting story about who I lived with at the time, Tom, when we all lived together. My roommate was Paul Languedoc.
Aha.
Who built my guitar.
Coincidentally or not coincidentally.
Would you like to talk about guitars?
Yeah. Wow, what a great segue. So that was a better segue, by the way, than mine.
So next week, we'll conclude this first deep dive into Trey's guitars with a new episode in which we don't stray off topic as much as we did this time. For those of you staying up to date, part two of this deep dive will be released on Monday, February 13th. I need to thank everyone I met in Mexico who had so many nice things to say to me about the Under the Scales podcast. It's very gratifying to hear and meet the actual people listening and learn what you like or what you recommend about the podcast, so thank you. I met so many nice new friends on the beach and shared tequila shots with some of you at Ulysses Bar near the adult pool. Lots of fun. We're constantly going to be changing, as you'll see. 2017 will be a big year for Under the Scales. We're working on episodes with a more audience-featured format. We have some amazing guests lined up. We're also going to be timing some episodes to coincide with certain events. More on that later. And lastly, I'm still contacting people even months after you submitted an idea to me, so please don't stop. If you have a topic in mind or want me to interview you, please click the Tell Your Story button at underthescales.com. Someone will get back to you if it's something that we're going to be able to do. Thank you, and I'll be back with Trey and Dan next week on Under the Scales.